Weaver.
Thanks very much. I understand that Phil, Rio, and Jason, whatever, are going to speak on behalf of the industry. Would you ask to speak?
Yes.
On behalf of?
The West Virginia Land and Mineral Owners Association.
Okay, why don't you speak for 5 o'clock?
Good evening. I won't take my 5 minutes here. My name is Jason Webb, and I represent the West Virginia Land and Mineral Owners Association, and I think we have a unique perspective as a shareholder in this issue. Our members sometimes own the surface only. Sometimes they own just the mineral, and in some cases they own the surface and the mineral rights. We've had the opportunity to meet with Soros and the industry throughout the year, as well as our gas committee has looked at this issue and they've been able to analyze, and we offered two suggestions on behalf of the West Virginia Land and Mineral Owners Association. The first is we feel it's necessary for an increase in the notification to 30 days, so from 15 to 30 days. The second thing is it's more of an educational piece. A lot of the issues occur because people do not know what their rights are. So we would suggest that whenever the individuals receive the notification, that there is like a website that the Office of Oil and Gas would develop for frequently asked questions and help people kind of navigate through this process. If they don't have access to a computer, then there would be a number that they could call the Office of Oil and Gas that could then send them the information. So those are the two things that the West Virginia Land and Mineral Owners Association supports. That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Webb. Mr. Rio?
Do I get 5 minutes or do I get the...
He has like 30.
30? Okay.
Gravity would be a surprise.
That might not occur. Mr. Chairman, members of Subcommittee A, thanks for the opportunity to appear before you today. Most of you know me. My name is Phil Rio. I represent the West Virginia Oil and Natural Gas Association and the Independent Oil and Gas Association of West Virginia, voices of an industry that directly employs 8,500 West Virginians and are responsible for employment in this state of over 21,000 people, according to the West Virginia Development Office. By way of background, the oil and gas industry has touched 53 to 55 counties in this state, and currently production going on in, I think, all but 7 counties in this state. We've got about 50,000 active gas wells in the state. The industry has been generating tax revenues for state government, property tax revenues for county governments in this state for since those taxes began. And they're extremely important to us. This industry was first began in the late 1850s in Burning Springs and Work County. The tools for which drilling occurred developed here in Kanawha County in the old salt industry. But I don't have to tell you that these are difficult economic times in which we live. And I don't have to tell you the impact of natural gas as well as coal and service taxes and the ability of our state to be buffered from some of the economic consequences that are going on in our state or in our country at this time. I want to let you know that there are a number of people in the room today and in the hallway outside that are members of this industry, individuals who are employees of companies. There are leaders of companies here. There are people from well tenders to CEOs. They hail from Lewis County. They hail from Kanawha County. Marion County, Raleigh County, Ritchie County, Wood County, Lincoln County, Usher County, Gilmer County. This is an industry that is very distributed throughout our state. Now, I normally would have a good sense of direction about how to strategically approach an argument or a debate about an issue of public policy. Today, that may not be the case. What we were asked to do, and what I will attempt to do today, is to provide you comments on the proposed legislation, effectively that would turn the law of several states on its head, and wholly disrupt the process of applying for a permit to drill a well as we know it today. It would unquestionably drive up the cost of conducting oil and gas operations in this state. And the fact that you'll hear later, I will explain to you exactly how it will make it prohibitive for a lot of companies. The proposed legislation actually also creates a whole new industry for those who want to sue this industry. And at the expense not only of the operators, but of the mineral owners. And also at the expense of the counties and the state of West Virginia that rely on the revenue generated by the industry. We were forwarded two pieces of legislation on Friday, 2 days ago, day before yesterday, at 2:41 p.m. One we understand to be under review by the committee was prepared by Mr. McMahon, I believe, was explained by staff counsel first today. The other was authored, we're told, by staff counsel. Both lawyers that prepared these bills are good lawyers, but I don't think either draft reflects much practical knowledge of what goes on in the oil and gas industry. And I doubt that either would suggest that they really did. Before we get into the substance of those drafts, I think it's important to get the committee some background information on the industry. Again, that we represent 100 years of operation in this state. We've got 10,000 wells. We've got about 50,000 active wells in the state right now. Billions of dollars of risk capital invested in this state without any incentive from anybody. Pipelines constructed. Pressure stations constructed and operated. Royalties. Now, here we're going to get into an area in which isn't even addressed in any of this legislation. There's a forgotten party in this. Jason just about got on here a minute ago. But there are thousands of West Virginians in our state who own mineral interests, who receive royalties on a regular basis from companies that drill wells on oil and gas interests that those people own. And they're not factored into this at all. This legislation, either version, materially impacts their ownership rights. In your packets, I'm providing you information on the law of severed estates, which I would have thought would have been something that this committee really ought to study. Make no question about it. Generations ago, when somebody owned, back the lawyers in the room, when you owned Blackacre, and you sold the surface of Blackacre and you reserved to yourself the mineral, all the coal, oil, and other gas, together with the right to develop the same, without liability for damage to the surface of the property. And it's been that way for generations. This industry inherited that situation. We didn't create it. We inherited it. And the issue today is the rub between the ownership of minerals versus the imposition on the surface estate when the minerals are developed. That's what the rub is. Now, how are you going about correcting that without compensating mineral owners for diminishing the value of their minerals and their right to extract the same isn't addressed. But I think you've got to think about this a little bit. You can look in your package, you'll see the property tax information. You'll see the fact that our development office establishes employment in this industry at 21,000 and direct employees at 8,500. And so I suggest to you that at a time when plants are closing down, when auto dealerships are reeling, when 1/6 of the population of our state is on food stamps, and more than 52% of our public school students are on free and reduced lunch, we can ill afford to put more people out of work. We are a state with the second worst college win rate in the country, the state with the lowest percentage of the population engaged in the workforce. So when we have an average per capita income of about $19,000 in our state, which is next to last in this country, and we have an industry with jobs paying an average of $60,000 that never asks for assistance from the state, puts billions of dollars of risk capital on the line, we need to think twice for what we're going to do here today, or potentially do. One of the few remaining viable industries in our state, and although it is currently in a significant slump, natural gas prices and oil prices are at 4- and 5-year lows right now, And people like my good friend Joe Petty, who's somewhere in this room or was, maybe he's outside right now. People have drilled, people who are drilling contractors, they've got equipment sitting in the yard. The liberal laying off people may have already laid off people. This isn't the panacea here that a lot of people think in terms of the wealthy getting wealthier. Now, is it a real problem? Is it a perceived problem? Is it a problem that is so pervasive that we need to modify and change the law in a dramatic fashion? Well, I suggest to you that there has been no evidence submitted, factual evidence submitted to this committee at any time. You had a brief meeting in August. You have today. You've not heard from the regulatory agency. I harken back to Senator Stallings doing a study on mental health in this state in which the lay of the land was determined, the problems were identified, the affected parties were brought in and talked about solutions to those problems, recommendations were made, a report was filed, it's now being implemented, and improvements are being made on that issue. That's not been the case here. 241 Friday, we get two bills. We get two bills, both of which provide for bonding in the event that you don't enter into a service owner use and compensation agreement, otherwise known as the vehicle that will extort money from companies. Now, what do I mean? You either enter into a service owner use and compensation agreement, or you enter into a interpretory. You had to post a bond, in Mr. McMahon version, $20,000 per well. In the committee version, $5,000 per well, which is on top of the $50,000 bond you've already given to the state for the purpose of ensuring compliance with environmental rules and regulations. Now, neither bill tells you who you deposit the bond with. We have heard testimony here today, and it is true, what's said in the bill. The bond lasts for the life of the well. Well, these are long-life wells. 20 years, 30 years, 50 years. You heard a count say maybe 100 years. Well, now, if a small operator in West Virginia drills 10 wells and can't come to an agreement with the service owner, that puts a $20,000 bond on one per well, that's $200,000. And there's not been any testimony taken with this meeting to determine whether you could buy a bond in today's market or not. You're either going to post a letter of credit or post cash. Bond isn't going to be there. So, let's take 10 wells today at $200,000. That's somebody who's going to have to commit to cash or a letter of credit. Now that's good to the next. Let's call it a 30-year life. Then next year you want to drill 10 more wells. Potentially the same situation. So you got another $200,000, you got to put on the line then for another 30. It doesn't take long to figure out here that people won't be able to afford to drill wells in West Virginia. You know, 3 or 4 years, you're $1 million out there. Small operators can't do it. It just says you can't do it. The point is, I think there's a lot of consequences to what's in a very simplistic approach trying to cure a problem that's extremely difficult. It has a lot of legal ramifications. I mean, has anybody given the thought to maybe consulting with those who teach the law of coal, oil, and gas, maybe at Western University, or consult the Mineral Law Foundation housed in Lexington, excuse me, housed in Lincolntown? There are a lot of very significant legal issues about the rights of those who own the oil and gas to develop that which they own. Now, in Mr. McMahon's bill, he sets it out. He sets out the controversy. And that is the people who own the surface do not benefit from the drilling of the well. Well, why is that? Because they don't own the oil and gas or coal, whatever it is that's being developed. That's owned by somebody else. They don't benefit from that ownership, but they don't own it.
Here's another thing. It's like, how do you enter into an agreement on a piece of surface that's been unairshipped? There's nothing here. You may have 20 people own a piece of surface. You may have somebody who's a 64th that lives down in Florida or Alabama or anywhere. It's just going to just, I don't care, I'm not signing it. So, what happens? The oil and gas operator can't then make an agreement. Basic textbook real estate law tells us that co-owners of a piece of land cannot commit their co-tenant to anything. They can't obligate their portion of the land or their portion of the ownership. I mean, I don't know how you deal with that. Under the committee version, you're into a situation there where if you don't have an agreement, and there's all kinds of reasons why people might not agree to something. First of all, in these both scenarios, you're being asked to look into a crystal ball and see into the future whether or not there's going to be damages and to what extent those damages are going to be, and then agree on it before anything ever occurs. So much of a possibility. So, if you can't come to an agreement, or if you've got multiple owners, perhaps some of which you can't identify, then either A, you don't drill, or B, you go ahead and post a bond, you go through the process, you finally get a permit, you finally drill, you can't get the bond released, or if you can't agree on the compensation, what then happens? Litigation. And then the committee version, on litigation, what happens? Oil and gas operator is exposed to pay attorney fees and costs to the service owner if there is no service owner using compensation agreement. So there's no incentive. And David gets into the business. He sends all an email getting into the business saying he's operating or going to have a practice established for the purpose of representing landowners against mineral owners. And this is a perfect bill to do that. Because there would be absolutely no incentive whatsoever. Well, I've got the email you sent to me. There's no incentive whatsoever for any surface owner to agree on compensation short of litigation. None.
Excuse me. Let's let Mr. Real make his presentation.
There's no incentive whatsoever, because you use that as the leverage to get the bid itself. Now, what does all this do to the family-owned small business, oil and gas business in this state? It just eliminates. And for the big guys, and some of them are in the room here today, they're number crunchers. They've got big money in some instances. And they will decide how to use that money, how they can best return a profit. And under these scenarios, it won't be here. Oh, there's still one of these going on here and there. There's no provision in these agreements. If you own the surface and the minerals, and you want to waive all this stuff and say, come say, hey, Doug Ross, you're a responsible operator. I want you to lease my land and drill my. I can't agree with him to go ahead and do it without going through a lot of extensive agreements, not agreements, waivers, whatever. We can't agree to develop my minerals. I want to know in the summer when the weather's good. It may take us till January to get a permit. The way it's structured here, there are a lot of things that I think we ought to have done with respect to a study. We don't have the objective forces of the state agency that governs this industry in the picture. We have never reviewed field practices commonly engaged in by industry. We have not talked about the very dangerous and highly risky prospect of requiring natural gas operators, non-public utilities, to provide domestic gas service on every piece of property. They're not equipped. They don't have a maintenance repairman on their payroll. So you're running the risk in using unprocessed gas in domestic facilities without having any standards whatsoever. No one has suggested that there might be a problem getting insurance for that sort of thing. Okay. I mean, it would be a huge item to get insurance for that sort of thing. And what the cost of that might be. Neither of these bills tells you who to file the bond with, and both of them make the service owner the quasi-regulator because only they can notify the surety company of when to release the bond. Well, the important thing to remember is that maybe, maybe 50 years from now, different service owners, different operators, there's no provision for transition in here from one owner to another, from one well operator to another. It's an extremely disturbing thing to think that we've gone through all of this and not had the kind of factual foundation laid, a determination of the lay of the land, and sat down at reasonable thoughts and tried to figure out if there's a way of addressing some of these things. I'm not saying they can't be done. They won't make everybody happy, and the reason it won't make everybody happy is that you cannot change the fact that 100 years ago, someone in this state decided they want to sever the surface from the mineral. How you reconcile that, how you deny people's mineral rights, the right to develop those minerals, you know. So I think we ought to talk to lawyers that understand that business and come up with recommendations if we're going to go that route. I think what this bill also does is it takes the risk of taking a lot of acreage out of production in our state that would otherwise be your own. Where there are multiple owners, where you can't come to agreements, where the risk is simply too large. I've rattled on here. Let me go ahead and just suggest to you that in your packet, there's a good summary of the law of severance in outline form. There's a good summary of the fact that surface owners are entitled to compensation. Delegate Allensburg asking some of the questions there. There is law in the book. Does it need to be enhanced or improved? That's a question to be developed and asked and try to come up with the right kinds of responses to that. And there's a whole, to say that somebody doesn't, before you can get a permit, you have to serve them. Most operators would not want to go out and survey a location unless they've had some conversation with the landowner, because they don't want to pay for that survey two or three times, as is the case sometimes where they don't have that relationship. Now, before the permit can be applied, you've got to have a survey, you've got to have a reclamation plan that tells you where the road is going to be, what the slopes are going to be, how it's going to be seeded and mulched, how it's going to be reclaimed, what kind of fertilizer you're going to use. You've got to identify the fresh water source. You've got to report all those things on your application permit, which has to be served on the surface owner at least 15 days prior to application for the permit. Within that period of time, and that time begins to run once you have certified that the Office of Oil and Gas, you do a certified mail return receipt or through an affidavit that there has been service of that
permit application on the surface owner. So he, the surface owner's got all the information. Y'all's oil and gas is going to get on the permit. So 15 days after that time that the Office of Oil and Gas understands the surface owner is when that permit may be issued. If the permit, issue the permit, issue with conditions based on comments perhaps that the surface owner made, or deny the permit. That's not what happens. If there are comments, there's an effort at reconciliation of the differences. But to say that they don't have information, I mean, I don't know how you do it. You can't start drilling until you've got a permit. So, I mean, somebody had to know. But I think it's the obligation of this committee to determine whether or not there's a pervasive problem, whether or not there are ways of addressing that problem, if there is a pervasive problem that does not put at risk the capacity of this industry to serve this state at a time when our administration in Washington now understands that energy security is national security, and that natural gas and clean burning fuel is the transition fuel of choice from which this state can dramatically benefit. We've had no comparative analysis of what current West Virginia law provides versus what's been proposed here today. And so I know it's talked too long, but the issues presented in this debate, they beg for comprehensive expert review. Including whether or not anything being done here might just give rise to lots of lawsuits for mental owners whose vested property rights are being impacted. These issues beg to have someone with a working knowledge of the oil and gas industry, including as to regulate the industry. These issues beg for a comprehensive analysis as to their economic impact on our state in terms of jobs lost, revenues to state government lost, revenues to counties lost, school systems lost. Let me just conclude by saying that this is an industry full of honorable people. There might be a bad apple here and there. There's a bad apple in every community. Long time, dedicated West Virginians desperately want our state to prosper and who do right by those with whom they interact. And there are occasions, obviously, we've heard some today. Is that the exception or is that the norm? I suggest to you it's the exception. Do we have laws on the books that take care of the exceptions? Absolutely we do. Whenever there's a disagreement that can't be resolved, you've got both common law and statutory remedies. You've got the opportunity to go through arbitration. When General Motors makes a car, they give you a warrant. Doesn't assure you that every part on that car operates properly, but it gives you the opportunity to have it fixed. And if it becomes so pervasive of a problem that it can't be fixed, then you've got a limit on it. Well, here we don't need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Can we afford to waste economic opportunities in West Virginia at this unique time in history? Absolutely not. Can the natural gas industry in West Virginia play a pivotal role in our state's future economy as well as the energy security of the country? Absolutely. Should we be careful and cautious before making dramatic public policy changes that have significant adverse impacts on working West Virginians, on thousands of mineral owners in our state who are absent from this debate? Certainly. Is there an urgency at this time for this committee to act? I suggest there isn't. As long as we're guided by the principle of doing what's best, what's fair for West Virginia, in her interest, then that should be what dictates our decisions in this matter. So, thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman. I have taken too much time. I would urge this committee to not make a decision on this until it has far more facts in front of it. On behalf of the 8,500 employees in this industry and the remainder of that 21,000 that
concern, whether it's a jumping red man here in Kanawha County that sells pipe and steel to the industry, to bankers and lawyers and accountants, surveyors and engineers, people with little field crews go out, clear land, and two guys in a truck kind of operation. I'm proud to be here and have this industry, and I have no, absolutely no hesitation or reservation that this industry is critical to the future of this state, and it is one that will, under the proper set of circumstances and the proper format, work close with members of this committee, and certainly to chair whom we have great respect, to address whatever issue the committee would ultimately determine to be addressed.